his campaign was called Walk While You Can. And since then, everything has become While You Can. Walk While You Can, Drink While You Can, Dance While You Can. And his book, which comes out at the end of March, is called Live While You Can. So that would be my answer. It's just do everything you can while you can.
Can I call you up, oh Alice, on a Friday night? We could reminisce on old days, and we could talk a while. Just sit and talk a while.
All right, I'm here with Adam Gane. Thanks a million, Adam, for coming around to have this chat with me. We met a few months ago, but we finally got around to sit down and have a chat. So the way I came about you was through Tony Coote, and that time I came over to interview Tony. How's he doing, by the way?
Tony's great. Yeah, he's great. He's obviously got a progressive degenerative disease, but he's a resilient man. He's positive and optimistic and happy, and he lives his life
to the fullest. Yeah,
yeah, he's incredible.
And you live with him at the moment, right?
I live with him. Yeah.
Is it that's 7 days a week or?
It's 5 days a week. Okay. Yeah, it's 5 days a week.
So you're one of the few nurses that he was talking about, and the few nurses around.
I'm not.
Okay.
No.
Tell me a bit
there
about.
So there's three, soon to be four, MND specialist nurses, and they work kind of, it's community nursing, so it's kind of like outpatients for the community. So they go to different houses and they pop in. So those nurses, they'd come out to us maybe once a month or once every 2 months. But there would be a lot of nurses around the country and a lot of carers that would look after people with MND. There's about, at any given time, there's about 400 people living in Ireland with MND.
Okay.
And a lot of them would have nurses and carers.
Okay.
So yeah, there is three or four official MND nurses, but throughout the country, there is kind of people that have that as a speciality.
Okay, okay. And, but before we come about how you decide to take this vocation stroke business or profession, any of that. I don't know what you call it. I would have called it vocation, but I'm sure. Tell me a bit more about you. Where were you born and tell me a bit about your background.
Okay.
Anything you
born
want.
Born in Dublin to two Dublin parents. I grew up in Mullingar and had a relatively normal childhood. My mum passed away when I was almost 12. So it was normal up to that point. And soon after that, I went to boarding school in Clongowes in Kildare, which I loved. And it was circumstantial. It was partly because of mum dying and my older siblings had all gone to college and stuff. So it was just fitting that I kind of went on, and I suppose Dad was on his own, so I was. Mum had planned this before she died. I remember she picked me up from school, from fifth class, and she said, "Look, I've booked you into this entrance exam for a place called Clongowes." And I was like, "What the hell is Clongowes?" And she's like, "It's a boarding school." And I was like, "Yeah, grand, whatever." I was never gung-ho for it, and I was never anti it, and the whole boarding school thing, it was never an issue. It was just like, yeah, okay, whatever. I went to the exam, actually. So she had booked it, she had booked me into this exam when I was in fifth class, and it was between the summer of fifth class and sixth class that she died, and it was September, so I was just starting sixth class and I had to go and do that entrance exam. And so it was kind of my word of the year is serendipity, and it's, I suppose, life is very serendipitous. And after she died, I was like, I think this is what mum wanted me to do, so I might as well just go to the school. So, Clongowes for 6 years, and spent a year in Africa after that, working with kind of underprivileged indigenous kids in Namibia. And then I did my nursing degree.
Well, and obviously, sorry to hear your mum passing, yeah. But and as a 12-year-old, I mean, that's it must have been really, really tough, right?
Yeah.
But obviously, your mum had a foresight of going, okay, like yeah. mothers do, got yeah. everything organized yeah. before I go.
Yeah. Yeah, well, she's incredible.
And did you know that was happening? Was it something? Did you know she was sick?
Yeah, she was sick for 5+ years.
Were you aware of it at that age?
I knew she was sick. I don't know if I knew she had cancer. I didn't know if that word registered. Even yeah. at 12, I thought I would have been old enough, but I don't think I ever really knew. And then, I suppose it was that summer, and we were told she's going to die at the end of the summer, oh. and. I was going to summer camp, and it happened to be in Clongowes. So I went to a summer camp to see what the school was like. And because it was July, they said, look, Adam, do you want to go or do you want to stay at home with mum? And I was like, well, she's not going to die until the end of the summer. So I'm safe. I can go away for a week and come back and see her and whatever. So I was such a child.
Oh, well, I suppose time doesn't really mean anything at that age, yeah.
No. And so I went, and she died during that week while I was in Clongowes. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I kind of carry with me. I don't believe in prognoses. I don't believe anyone should ever be told when they may or may not die. Because no doctor, consultant, nurse, nobody has that knowledge or control. And whether you're faithful or not, I think it's not within our control. It's out of our hands. So I don't believe in somebody being told, oh, they're going to die in 4 months, because it could be 6, could be 10, could be 1.
Yeah. Unfortunately, you lived it through between yeah. your mother and your patients ever since.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's some story. So your first song, anyway, it's Under the Bridge by Red Hot Chili Pepper. Why did you pick that one?
So this is probably my introduction to music. This album was released in May 1991, so I was almost 4. Now, it was probably a few months after after that date, but my brother Ivan brought me into his room, and he said, the way I remember it is he said, sit down and listen to this, and he played the album Blood Sugar Sex Magic. And I don't know if I really enjoyed it or if I was just trying to be cool for my brother, but I was like, yeah, it's cool. And I suppose that was my introduction to music, and I do genuinely love the Red Hot Chili Peppers now. I was going to go with something off the B-sides, but it's a classic.
Sometimes I feel like I don't have a partner. Sometimes I feel like my only friend is the city I live in, the city of angels. Lonely as I am, together we cry. I drive on the streets 'cause
I want to stay a little bit with the school, college. Okay, so you went into Clongowes, spent 6 years there. And during that time, what was, boarding school? I've never been to boarding schools, so I don't know. You enjoyed it.
Yeah.
What did you enjoy about it? What was the thing that really kind of drove you?
The camaraderie.
Okay.
Yeah, and the development.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Was it an all boys school?
All boys. All right, Catholic, better. Irish boarding school. Just the guys that I went to school with, they are friends, but they're more like family. We're brothers. I'd say, yeah, there was a lot of development. I think like we got away with murder. And looking back, I can't go on record on some of these stories, but some of the stuff we did, it's outrageous, but just good fun. Most of it good natured, never too malicious or sinister, but we had a lot of fun at school.
You were building up your memory banks for
yeah.
people that are still friends of yours today.
Yeah.
So would you regularly meet with them? And at the moment, or life just taking a difference?
Yeah, not as much as I'd like to. Obviously, a lot of guys take different paths and they head off to different countries and they've all migrated and whatnot. But like, we have an annual Christmas dinner. Now, a lot of these guys are in Dublin, but if I have a day off, I'll tend to spend time with my family. I also love spending time by myself.
Yeah.
But I have a few guys that I'm particularly close with that I'd see more regularly.
And in terms of when you were, okay, you're up to all the things you're supposed to get up to when you're a teenager, especially in boarding school.
Yeah.
But what about academically? Were you into your study? Was it something that kind of not really, you were just...
Like, primary school, I was really bad. And years later, Dad would tell me that he was called into the principal regularly. And I think, I wasn't aware of this, but I think I got away with murder because Mum was sick. I wasn't taking advantage of it. I didn't realise that I was that much trouble, but apparently I was. And then I went to boarding school, and it was, I was never a great student, but over those 6 years, I did improve. And until I got to I did a good leaving cert. And then throughout college as well, my grades just slowly, I was always a C student. But by the time I left college, by the time I was doing my final exams, I think I finished all A's.
Wow.
So it's just, I just kind of, it took a long time, but I found my rhythm. And I love exams, I love assignments, I love college, I miss it. I may or may not go back someday.
No, but that is interesting, because you hear those stories a lot, that the leaving cert or the whole secondary school is just too much of a push for some of us, you know.
And,
but then you find, you decide to, what did you decide to go into nursing? What drove you to go into nursing?
I suppose when you're 16, you do, what's it called? Work experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, my mum was a nurse, but I don't think, I always defend that wasn't a factor in me becoming a nurse. She was never a nurse as long as I was alive. Mm-hmm. You know, she was retired, she had four guys, the fourth kid.
Mm-hmm.
But to be brutally honest, I did that work experience in St. Francis Hospital down in Mullingar, and I said, I'll try out nursing. And I fell in love with this 28-year-old nurse, and I was 16 at the time. And there was chocolate, loads of chocolate on the ward. And I figured out their work schedule was like, they work 3 days a week and they get 4 days off. And being a young 16-year-old heterosexual male, I was surrounded by women. And so those three factors, chocolate, 4 days off a week, and being surrounded by women. Now, there's probably a bigger factor at play. When I was in secondary school, there was two people that had a huge influence on me. One was my biology teacher, Kevin Mom. And he particularly led us away with murder. So there's always messing in the class, but he had a very fun way of delivering his classes. And I suppose I absorbed it all, and I really love biology. His wife, Mary Mom, was one a school psychologist, but she was involved in a lot of social outreach in school. And so she kind of instilled a love for caring for people. And that's when I first kind of saw the reward in looking after somebody or that sort of stuff. It was a lot of intellectual disability stuff.
Okay, well, then the next song is probably very fitting, Angel by Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
Why did you pick Angel?
I suppose I discovered, when I look at music, I look at who influenced the artist. And so I know that Jimi was a huge influence to the Chili Peppers. So over time, I fell in love with Jimi Hendrix. Jimi is my number one now. Chili Peppers kind of fallen behind. They've gone a bit too poppy. But Jimi is my number one. But this particular song... is he talks about, he had this dream about 2 years before his mum died, and she was on a camel and she was going under these trees, and he could see like the shade of the leaves on her face and stuff. And she said to him, I'm not going to be around for too long, you know, I'll see you. And it's fitting for me because 2 weeks after my mum died, I had a dream. We were in Roundstone on the pier. And there was, again, there was not a canopy of trees, but it was a canopy of a kind of gondola or a gazebo thing.
Mm.
And I saw her, and even in my dream, I knew that she had passed away, and I ran away crying. And so probably about 4 weeks after she died, I had the same dream again. And I saw the canopy and I went up to it and she was there. And I suppose it was a little bit lucid, the dream, because I knew that she was dead, but I wanted to, I ran up to her and I just hugged her and I kissed her and I told her I missed her. And it was, and Jimmy talks about this dream about his mum and how he'll never forget it, and he never did. And that dream is just so profound.
Angel came down from heaven yesterday. She stayed with me just long enough to rescue me. And she told me a story yesterday about the sweet love between the moon and the deep blue sea.
You mentioned going off to Africa when that was right after college or
after school.
After school,
yeah, it was a gap year.
Okay,
yeah.
So gap year. What drove you to go to Africa? And how did you get there? I mean, you were 18, 19 or something?
I think I was 19. Yeah.
Why Africa? And why? What happened there?
We have family friends that they come over every Christmas Eve, and they had kind of been regular volunteers over there. It's a family called the Harringtons. Mm. And it was one Christmas Eve, I suppose I was probably around 16 at the time, but my older sister Sophie was she was doing her leaving cert. So the Harringtons were over for Christmas Eve and they said, look, Sophie, we think this might be a good opportunity for you. You know, we've been going to Namibia for years and it's a great place, it's a great school, great spirit, very welcoming, very warm. And I was like, look, it's going to be another 2 years before I'm her age, but that's something I would love to do. They just sold it. Mm. And yeah, 2 years later, I kind of reached out to Una Harrington. I said, look, I'd love to do that. And it was just a matter of booking flights. And
what did you do when you were there?
A lot of drama, music, English, maths, kind of more remedial stuff. But I suppose our main classes were like PE and art.
So you were teaching?
Kids. There's also boarding school, but it's for primary students.
Okay.
And they're from kind of very indigenous parts of Namibia, a lot of farm kids and people from poor areas of the country.
What was that like as an experience? Do you reckon it made an impact on you?
Yeah, I think so. I'm 31 now. I think I've been out to Africa about 10 times since I was 19. So every other year, I've tried to go out.
To the same place?
Usually, yeah. Usually the same school.
And tell me something, what is it like now? I mean, has the 10, 15 years changed anything?
It's changed hugely.
In what way?
I suppose, I remember we had mobile phones at the time, but there was only, this school is probably, or village is probably 1 kilometer by 1 kilometer. And there was a little, if you can imagine, like a piece of toilet roll or toilet paper, just one square. And there was a place in a building at the far end of the village. And if you put your phone on this piece of toilet paper, that was the only area that you had network in the whole village. And if it wasn't on that piece of paper, there was no, it was very, very rural. Now they have Wi-Fi and phone network and there's masts and all sorts of stuff. But you see, this village is probably 400 or 500 kilometers north of the capital. And just driving through the towns now, if I was to go back there and drive through the towns, you just see villages have turned to towns, and towns are nearly cities now.
So the indigenous people you were dealing with at the time, now they're kind of assimilated into the progress that's happening. Is that for the better or for the worse, you reckon?
I don't know. There's one tribe called the Himbas. And they rub, I think it's cow fat and the earth together, and they rub it on their skins and they rub it into their hair, and they kind of dance over smoky fire to clean themselves and stuff. And they're very, very indigenous, and they're, you know, semi-naked and whatnot. Mm. And now you might come across them wearing a wristwatch or a Manchester United jersey. Or there's once I was in Tanzania and I was sitting in an internet cafe doing my bits and bobs. And I saw a Maasai warrior sitting beside me. And I took a photo of him. But I just kind of sat back in my chair and I looked to see what he was doing. He was on Facebook. like a Maasai warrior with his cane, and it was just like times have changed.
That is a bit stranger, right? Yeah. Yeah, because I'm always curious of that idea. I mean, do the indigenous population really want to be part of our world? Are we doing the right thing? I'm not sure.
I don't know. I think it's just all kind of finding a level plateau, I don't know. Yeah.
But you know, obviously you're part of that through the teaching and things, so you're part of creating that. It's important to speak English and to, but
yeah, I always bring over like Irish t-shirts and Irish jerseys and stuff. I was like, yeah, give it to my mates and stuff. And
that was great. So yeah. And do you go anywhere else for volunteering, or just Africa has been the only thing?
Africa's been the main place I've gone. Yeah, that's pretty much it, really. I did since do a diploma in tropical nursing.
Okay.
Over in Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine. And so the goal, the dream is to pursue this career of kind of global development and tropical nursing. And I don't know if it's going to be HIV or malaria or malnutrition, or there's just a lot of, it's something I'm very passionate about. There's a lot of very easily preventable diseases that people are dying from in mass numbers every day all over the world. And it's something I'd like to be a part of in preventing that.
Brilliant. You have the Beach Boys. Old Man River.
Yeah. This is simply just a song that reminds me of my dad. It's usually it's sung in bass, and it's Showboat. I think it's from Showboat, and it's sung by a guy called Joe, who's a black man working on the boat, and he's talking about the hardship of being one of the workers on the boat. And my dad played Joe in the Mullingar Arts Centre years and years and years. I don't even know. I think it might have been before I was born. But I suppose it's one of his party pieces. And it's just, to be honest, having one parent, there's always a fear. And I find this song quite emotional because, I always picture hearing this song at his funeral, which I know is really morbid, but it's just a song that reminds me of my dad. He's very precious to me. He's my only parent left. You know?
How's he doing?
He's great. Yeah, he's pushing 70. He's 68. He's pushing 70, and he's as fit as he's ever been. He cycles 40 miles a day, and he's nearing retirement, and he looks after himself. Yeah.
Got into nursing then after your college. Where did you start working? You start in hospitals, or how? What was? Tell me a bit about nursing. I know nothing about nursing other than a nurse is the person normally shows up when you're not well, and just before the doctor comes in and signs a piece of paper.
Yeah, exactly.
But you guys are the ones doing all the work. Yeah. A lot of them.
I agree.
And unfortunately, we all been. Near a hospital or a nurse or something, and there is, in fairness. But tell me a bit about your journey into nursing. Where did you start, and what did you do?
I suppose, like, initially I never agreed with this term vocation. It's just something I suppose I wanted to do. I've often seen it as kind of, a part of me kind of dips into this idea of it being a selfish job for me, because there's so much reward and it's so enjoyable. It's like, I think Winston Churchill said, if you love your job, you'll never work a day in your life. And there are certainly days I felt like I have worked, but and work is busy. It's a tough job, but I love it. And the reward, the reward you get from making someone feel better. It's a very simple thing, and it's my job. I get paid to do it. It's not a selfless love. I'm not. It is out of the goodness of my heart, but I don't know.
No, I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
It's a job as well as a vocation.
It's a job, but it is a vocation. Yeah. And it's taken me years to discover that. But to answer your question, I left college. I'd been working with this agency, Nurse on Call, for throughout my degree to kind of pay my way. And when I qualified as a nurse, they kind of reached out to me and said, look, we need a male nurse, preferably a male nurse, to work for this guy out in Greystones. And he's got motor neuron disease, and he's on a ventilator, and he's got a tracheostomy. And I'm like fresh out of college. I'm like, I don't think I'd be comfortable. Well, one, the distance. I was like, it's 27 kilometers, which isn't huge. I know people do a lot more than that. But it's my first job. I said no. And they rang me back a week later and they said, look, we'd really love you to work for this guy. And I said no. And they just hounded me. And eventually this one particular girl, Sheena, said, look, just do a week. Just go and do a week with this guy. And if you don't like it, you're done. If you do like it, whatever. So six years I spent with Simon Fitzmaurice, who's one of the biggest inspirations in my life. We were brothers, you know. The whole professional relationship between nurse and patient, it doesn't really exist in home care. You hopefully become part of the family, and I definitely feel I became part of their family. They're so warm and welcoming, and Simon was, I don't know, there's not many words to describe who or what he was, but he was an incredible man. He sadly passed away last year. He's just a huge inspiration, and he was family, and he was a great friend.
Yeah, because you spent 6 years there, again, 5 days a week or thereabouts. Mm. So I know Ruth. I did know Simon. I read a book, and I read her side of the story, mm-hmm. of, and I spoke to Ruth for this podcast as well.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to hear from your side. You said that was one of the questions. How do you become part of it without being in the way, if you want one thing about it? Well, because, you know, you're there to help Simon,
yeah.
but you're in a family home, and you're, yeah. How does that, like, you morph into, as you say, brotherhood, and just become part of the landscape? Or how quickly did that happen? From going in kind of reluctantly, I was like, go in and see what it's like, 27 kilometers there. And then obviously you enjoyed it enjoy maybe it's not the right word.
No, it would be, yeah. No, I loved it. I suppose I probably started off quite shy. And then slowly we got to know each other, and he got to know the real me. And he just lived such a full life. Like, we went to, he wrote the film and he wrote the book, and there was a documentary made about him, and the film My Name Is Emily went international, and we went to Toronto Film Festival, and we went to Galway Film Festival, we went to London and Edinburgh, and so we did traveling together, you know. It's just it's just not a regular nursing job. And I'm blessed in that sense, like to land this position, and I was in a very privileged position to be looking after Simon. But it just, I suppose, it can't not happen. If you spend that much time with somebody and you see so much of their life, and in turn, you show them the parts of your life. And yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. I'm going to ask you a couple more things on that. You've Tchaikovsky, Sleeping Beauty, I believe.
Number 66, number 7. Yeah. It's the waltz from Sleeping Beauty.
Okay.
This is another song that really, really got me emotional. Now, it reminds me of my sister, Sophie. But I think at a very fundamental level, it just brings me back to pre-1999 when Mum was alive. And so this song just, I don't know why it's so evocative. It just brings me back to my childhood and watching Sleeping Beauty with my sister. And I took my sister, it was her birthday a few years ago, well, it's her birthday every year, but it was one particular birthday a few years ago. There was a series of Russian ballets being performed in the National Concert Hall, or the music from the ballets. And this was one of them, and I know how important it is to her. And I was like, we have to go. So I bought her a ticket for herself and myself. Actually, no, I think I bought it for her and her boyfriend, but she decided to give the ticket to me. So We went, but for weeks before this concert, I had to listen to this song repeatedly until I could listen to it without crying. I'm a very emotional person.
Yeah, that's okay.
But it's this, yeah, it's another very evocative song to me, very personal, and it just brings me back to my childhood.
I just want to go back to Simon Fitzmaurice in the job you had with him for 6 years, because he had motor neuron disease, which unfortunately is non-curable disease and degenerative disease. And as you said at the beginning of this conversation, nobody can tell you when and if, but unfortunately there is no if in MND. It's going to happen. It's just so you pretty much knew that from... Okay,
well, there's no if for anyone. You know,
absolutely. You know? But, Sam was a fairly young man, and unfortunately, it went relatively quickly. But then again, when you were there, when you started, you got into it, you started to create a rapport with Simon. And at that stage, then you knew that your relationship with him, that job with him wasn't going to last forever, right? Mm-hmm. You knew it was going to be a short term. How do you deal with the daily notion there? Because Simon, when you first met him, was he still talking, or was he already on to...
He was ventilated, but he still could talk a little bit, and he was kind of at a stage where he was transitioning towards using the eye gaze computer. So he was talking, but it was becoming less understandable, I suppose.
That's what I'm curious about, the knowledge that disease was rapidly changing him, and how do you deal with that? Because obviously it's your profession, but also it's an inspiration to you. The guy, Simon, was an inspiration to you, and you became friends, you became brothers. How do you deal with that every day, knowledge that he's not going to be there forever? He's not going to be there for too long.
I think the philosophy that I've taken from probably both Simon and Ruth, the best way to deal with most things is day by day. Okay. And I never really thought about Simon dying. You know, even if he got a bad chest infection, it was like, grant, antibiotics, see what we can do. And usually we clear up and then go away. And unfortunately, on one particular occasion, he ended up getting sick and, go to hospital. And it was a slow process for him to go home. Not home, but... to the good Lord, or wherever he went, to the heavens, and it wasn't. Yeah, it was a slow and painful process, and I suppose I didn't think about him dying until maybe a month or 2 months before he died, but he outlived what the doctors had prognosed. The way he outlived it.
Yeah, I suppose that's where your skills, your personal and professional skills come in. So you go, okay, right, it's time for an antibiotic, it's time for a walk, whatever. Yeah. You make the call as the legs and ears and of. Yeah. That's interesting. Were you just through the process of writing, he was writing books and movies at the same time, were you part of that in any way, as in... Like bouncing off ideas more than anything else. Was it something that you were kind of,
I've been working for him, I'd say less than a year, and he gave me the script for My Name is Emily. And I read it, I was on night duty at the time, so I read it over two or three nights. And I remember he said to me, he's like, what do you think about Arden's father? And Arden's father was not by any means, not one of the most important characters in this film. I'm like, what was Arden's? And it's, you're reading it, you're not watching the film. So you're reading a script and it's got all the other input, director's input into it. And I was like, oh, fuck, I'm after reading the whole thing and I don't know who Arden's father. And I was like, oh, is that the asshole? Oh, yeah, he hit Ireland. Yeah, he was not. And he's like, is he believable? Is the father believable? I was like, yeah, some dads hit their kids. I was like, of course it's believable. It happens, you know, and, you know, it depends who you cast. And I to answer your question, I didn't have a huge input, but I remember reading the script and I said it to his parents one day. I was like, oh, yeah, Reg, my name is Emily. It's really good. I can't wait for the process to start. And they're like, we've never read it. But I know, like, it had already been sent to producers and stuff. So I think I was one of the first few. Ruth had read it, but I was one of the first few to read it. Wasn't hugely involved in the process.
Not so much. I was just curious because obviously you created such a close bond with him That's great. That's great. Okay, tell me about the Jack Kerouac October in the Red Road.
Like I said, my original song here was going to be On the Road, Can't Heat. But again, it's too much of a classic. I wanted to go for something different. And one of my beliefs is that sharing music is one of the greatest gifts. Music and music and smells, I like to share. Not bad smells, good smells, like perfumes and amber and incense and whatever. So, Jack Kerouac, I don't know, this song or this piece or this spoken word, it brings me back to I did a bike trip across the States from LA to Boston. Now he's talking about the 1950s, but there's just, when you hear it, it just brings me back, just the way he talks about old America and trucks and cars and whatnots and railroads and all that sort of stuff. So it's nothing too sentimental. It's not a hugely important song to me, but I love listening to it, particularly in the car. It brings me back to road tripping.
There was a little alley in San Francisco, back of the Southern Pacific Station at 3rd and Townsend, in red brick of drowsy, lazy afternoons with everybody at work in offices. In the air you feel the impending rush of their commuter frenzy, as soon they'll be charging en masse from market and Sansom buildings on foot and in buses and all well-dressed through working man Frisco of walk-up truck drivers. And even the poor grime-bemarked 3rd Street of lost bums, even Negroes, so hopeless and long left east.
Just a couple of more things about the MND, because it's just a cruel disease. And I had the pleasure and the fortune to meet with Tony in his house recently, and I did say it, and I said it to anybody I met. It was one of the most inspirational conversations I had, and it was fantastic to be able to ask him about religious matters, and he was so open about everything. Yeah, it was great. And so you're there now. What would you say to people? It's just a hard thing to, when you see somebody with MND, just don't know. I don't know how to react. I don't know what you're supposed to do or not supposed to do. But then inside, as you say, Tony is full of life, is living to his fullest. What would you say to somebody like myself, meeting somebody with an MND? What are we supposed to do? Like you leave it every day. For you, it's not normal, but that's your 8th year working with somebody with MND between Simon and Tony. So you're more accustomed to it.
It's very easy to answer. And again, it's a philosophy probably from Tony. He did this walk from Donegal to Bayes. He walked the length of the country with a troop of 100 plus on a rotation basis. But he walked the length of the country last year to raise money for the IMNDA and RMND, Research Motor Neurone Disease. And his campaign was called Walk While You Can. And since then, everything has become while you can. Walk while you can, drink while you can, dance while you can. And his book, which comes out at the end of March, is called Live While You Can. So that would be my answer. It's just do everything you can while you can. And it's one of the life philosophies as well. It's like, sadly, Tony is passing away potentially faster than others, but we are all in that process. I think it was Oscar Wilde said, if you're not busy being born, you're busy dying. And I think, again, it's very morbid, might be a morbid thought process, but I think if you are aware of your own mortality, you might live your life a bit more and just live it.
But in terms of meeting the likes of, like, I felt really at ease talking to him, and But I can understand that sometimes it could be, there's a pity from an able body, whatever you want to call it, towards somebody in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
But I know for a fact, having met Tony, that's not what he wants. You know, he wants to be talking to Tony like he was when you were talking to him last year. So is that something that you've witnessed, that if you're walking around with him, going to the shop or whatever, do you notice people kind of reaction to, should it be a little bit more relaxed about it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, people are so, not uptight, people are so cautious. Like he's okay. Like he has this terminal disease. But as I say, you know, life is terminal. One thing that happens when you end up in a chair, and I don't know if it's the same for everyone, but people talk to you louder. Are you okay? Can I get you anything? And it's like, his hearing is fine. His hearing is fine. He can hear you. Just talk to him normally. And it's, some people come and they have this, the face of empathy or sympathy. And it's kind of like, just talk to him normally, you know. Don't talk about chair, the disease, or the speech, or the you know, and how's that? And is everything? It's like, just, you know, have a chat. It's grand, you know.
So that is important for him, obviously, or for anybody that is in that situation.
Yeah. Now, having said that, I know most people in chairs and most people terminal, they don't want pity, but I do sometimes. My heart breaks from. I see what he goes through. Like it's a really hard disease. It's really tough. It's one of the worst, and it's really hard to witness all that.
Yeah, it's and that I came about you not because of Tony, because of a friend, common friend, Galen.
Yeah,
so you got to talk to Adam. You know, he's a great guy, and he did. You know, in fairness, that's why we're here. And you're very emotional, which is great. It's great to know you have a heart. But genuinely, because it doesn't matter whether you want to call it vocation or not, but it is your vocation. Yeah. You're there spending time with a great man that unfortunately is going to, your relationship with him is going to be as long as you like it to have it, you know. But no, it's good to hear that for the likes of myself, meeting somebody on the chair, for whatever the reason they're on the chair, especially if it's MND, yes, be normal. Don't make it worse than it is, you know. They will let you know, I suppose, if they need to be if they need a bit of pity or not, you know. Yeah. And then, by and large, they don't.
Yeah. That's a crack. We all like a bit of crack.
What you just mentioned the trip across the States. You're into your bikes, are you, or you just you wear?
Yeah, I was or I am. I don't know. I'm once a biker, always a biker.
Right.
But I've been riding bikes for 12, 13, 14 years, and. Love the bikes. I once had a bit of a inheritance from my granny, and I just flew to the States and bought a motorbike and drove across the States, and with the intention of selling that same bike. So I started in LA and finished in Boston. Plan was drive across, sell the bike, come home, go back to work. This is while I was working for Simon. So that was one of my coping mechanisms was. I'd say once a year I would take 2 months off. So and regrettably I felt awful about it. And actually there's another song which isn't on my list, but High and Dry by Radiohead. I feel like I so often left Simon high and dry, but I had to do it for my own mentality and so that I could come back and be but yeah, drove across the States.
Did you do it on your own?
Did it by myself, yeah.
How long did it take you?
About 6 weeks.
Nice.
And it was just plain sailing, so easy. And
what bike did you bike?
It was a Honda Shadow 750 American Classic Edition.
Nice.
And I remember people asking me on that trip, "Oh, why are you doing this? Is it you're doing it for charity?" And I was like, "No, just
own self care."
I had the money somehow and decided to do it. But then, the bike didn't sell in Boston, so I was like, look, I'm not going to leave it there. I just shipped it home, and I had fallen in love with the bike. So I shipped it to Ireland, which was, again, very, very expensive. And then a few years later, so I was back in, that was the States was back in 2014. In 2017, I think, I decided to do a charity trip. So it was for Pieta House and the IMNDA. And I drove to technically Asia, but it was Istanbul, Asia and back, because you go past the Asian border.
Mm.
So my campaign was called Asia and Back. Cool. And so I went down through mainland Europe, down through the Balkans and into Turkey and around southwest Turkey, back through Greece and Italy and Sardinia and kind of ferry hopping across. And
all on your own again?
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Yeah. That was a horrible, no, it wasn't a horrible trip, but it was really tough. The engine died, I had to replace it. The Cyrillic alphabet, just all the different languages, a few different currencies, and it was really hard. I don't regret it, but it was really hard and really fast paced, and it just wasn't as chilled as the States. And because I was video vlogging, I was spending like 3 or 4 hours every night putting a video together based on the day that I just had. So I was in Naples, but never went to Pompeii, which is a 15-minute drive, and.
So it felt more like work than...
Yeah, it's a really fast pace. I came back exhausted. It was not a holiday. It was 2 months of endurance, but it was good. It was great.
Well, that's a perfect song then, yeah. Your Long Journey, Alison Krauss and Robert Plant.
Yeah. Well, this song it's actually more to do with Simon. And it's the album Raising Sand. It is fitting. The album Raising Sands. Simon would have a regular repertoire of albums that he would play in the morning. So it would be Meatloaf, Raising Sand, I can't remember the other ones now. I can't remember. But anyway, this album he used to listen to, and I suppose you can often hear a song many, many times without listening to the lyrics. And it wasn't until after he died that I actually listened to this song, and when I heard the words, it just killed me, because it's about death, and it kind of brought me back to those mornings. You know, getting Simon out of bed was not a quick process. You know, it took an hour or so, and so when I first listened to the lyrics, I thought back. I was like, Jesus. Simon used to listen to these words, and it was so reflective on the process that he was going through, and I suppose maybe his awareness of his mortality, and it's also a very, I don't know how to describe the song, it's powerful, it's not, I wouldn't say it's morbid, I'd say it's peaceful.
God's given us years of happiness here, now we must part. And as the angels come and call for you, the pains of grief tug at my heart. Oh, my darling, my
just mention a couple of things about, and that was one of the questions I had for you about a coping mechanism. Because obviously, your job is it's physically demanding, but it's also mentally very demanding, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Okay, apart from going off on these mad road trips, what do you do on a daily basis or on a weekly basis too, for your mental fortitude, for your mental well being and physical well being?
Yeah, I'm not great at exercise. Luckily, I have good metabolism, so I don't really need it. I'm sorry, but no, I'm not great at exercise. But I do get a regular enough massage. That's good for the head. Mm-hmm. And I've no qualms about saying this. I'm trying to break the taboo of mental health and stuff, but I go to therapy once every 2 weeks, psychotherapy.
Sure.
I think there's M. Scott Peck, The Road Less Traveled.
Mm-hmm.
He mentions that even people with really, really good mental health should go to psychotherapy.
You know, like prevention better than the cure type of thing?
Yeah, and I'm at a stage where I don't feel I need it, but it's available to me, and I'm taking it. you know, and it's great.
Is that available to you? It's part of your job that you do in this part. Oh, that's interesting. That's good.
I'm technically employed by the Dublin Diocese, and they talked about going into this before I was employed and working for Tony. They said, look, we know that, obviously, they could see from my CV, and they knew my history and stuff, but they said, look, you've obviously come out of a job where you looked after this patient for so long, and you were obviously assumably close with him, and they asked me straight out, did you get therapy after Simon died? I said, no, it wasn't something that was available. I did actually ask my employer at the time, but it wasn't available.
That's interesting.
And they said, look, if you're going to take this job and look after Tony, we think it might be a good idea. And I said, yeah, great. Thanks. Mm. Like, it's so responsible as an employer. Like, they're brilliant. They are so supportive. I'm not religious or necessarily a member of the Catholic Church, but they're an incredible support. They are great employers. They really look after me.
And do you find the therapy working? Do you find it helpful?
Yeah. Come out of there and I feel great. Just come out. I walk out into this. I go see this girl, and I walk out into her driveway. And I just take a few big deep breaths of fresh air and get back into the car, and it helps. And we talk about anything and everything, and it's not like the same topic every week. Sure. It's I don't know what's going to come out next, but it's just venting and good chats.
Great. And are you doing anything like meditation or anything like that? Yeah.
So myself and Tony do a bit of meditation together, sometimes up the church. Previously we've done it at home, just between the two of us. Sometimes I do some by myself upstairs. I do like a candle meditation where you kind of darken the room a little bit, and you just light a candle, and you don't stare at the candle, but you just like a gaze into the candle. And maybe put on a bit of music, and that's one of my meditations. They also say riding a bike is meditation, so that's and driving a car is meditation. You don't need to actively meditate. There's lots of things in life, cooking,
sure,
whatever you find that. Wherever you find your Zen, that's your meditation.
That's great. And I mean, I spoke to quite a few people through this process of the podcast, and people that do offer therapy as part of their jobs, but they all say the same thing: self care is the most important. Yeah. Unless you're well, you can't help anybody else, you know. And you mentioned earlier as well the selflessness as such, but also selfishness when helping other people. But there must be so many rewards of doing what you're doing. Yeah. Like, they must outweigh the bad days, is it? Like, you just...
I've mentioned this to a few people, and I don't want to take away too much from what I had with Simon. But I was with Simon for 6 years, and I've known Tony for about 6 or 7 months. But I suppose because of the nature, I'm now a live-in nurse, as opposed to when I looked after Simon, I was agency and I was popping out 3 or 4 times a week. But I'm a live-in nurse now with Tony. We live together. We're friends. We're brothers. We're family. We're good mates. And I love Tony. Like, at a personal level, we love each other, and we get on so well. Now we have our argy-bargies, like you would with anyone if you're living together. There's this term, actually a term in psychotherapy, I think, is rupture and repair. And those fights are good in any sort of loving relationship. Those, you know, after the fight, you come back stronger. But it's, I suppose, Tony has given me so much. In 6 months, he's given me a lifetime of wealthy information and philosophies and ways of living, and just his outlook on life and his mentality and everything. He's an incredible, incredible human, and he's just inspiring.
It is, it absolutely is. And so in terms of, you mentioned the future, you mentioned ideally you would like to get involved in some... preventable disease like malaria, or there's so many of them that, as you say, the malaria kills, I don't know, many millions every year. It's just ridiculous. Is that what you're thinking longer term? Just getting away from this one-on-one nursing and getting into or?
One of the problems with nursing is that there's too many options. Okay. There's so much work out there that I just wouldn't know where to go. And I said after Simon died, I ended up working for Oxfam, going door to door asking people for their bank details as a direct, to sign up as a direct debit. And it's, you can imagine how hard it is to ask somebody or get somebody's bank details at their front door, and you're just a cold caller to gain their trust and be like, yeah, come on, we're saving lives and all this sort of. But anyway, I was out in this sort of weather going door to door through, like, Simon died in October, you know, November, December, January, February, just the worst months you could be out in the road doing door to door. And the reason why I didn't go straight back into nursing was because I believed at the time I would never, ever find a job as personal or as enjoyable or as, I never thought I'd find anything like I had with Simon. And now I'm in a very different but very similar situation. And Tony is incredible. As I said, yeah, I can't say enough about the guy, but it would take someone very special to come along, maybe with motor neurone disease, and say, Adam, will you work for me? I wouldn't do it for anyone.
Okay.
It's hard. And I think, I've always tried to pursue this career of tropical nursing, and every time something comes up, and the last thing that came up was Tony. And he's like, I'd like you to work for me. And I said, yeah, I think I will.
Fantastic. So listen, just before the last song, I always ask everybody a couple of words of wisdom. Anything, a quote. You have plenty of quotes for.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Tell us one. Something gets you up in the morning.
My favorite, another Oscar Wilde one, and it's, I might be paraphrasing. Keep love in your heart. The consciousness of loving and of being loved brings warmth and richness to life that nothing else can bring.
Sounds fabulous. Sounds fabulous. Give me your last song. I can't read it without my glasses.
Oh, yeah. There. So this is, I suppose, yeah, having been in Africa and stuff, just my love for music. And it's, again, it's not sentimental. It's just a song that I feel should be shared. These artists, Amadou and Mariam, they're a married couple. They're both blind. They're from Mali. And the song is called Senegal Fast Food.
Well, Adam Gaines, that was a fantastic conversation. Thanks a million for taking the time. And talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Janeiro.